Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, October 26th, 2017. Some IDPs at a UN camp that Ambassador Haley visited in Juba were upset about not being able to meet the ambassador.
We are celebrating, the community are celebrating, but the reaction has happened after the act denied the community to meet with a visitor.
And some young South Sudanese men take on jobs that others consider unsuitable for men.
Many guys after culture, they tuck in, they work smart, but you see them suffering. I myself decide I better do like other countries. Ugandan, Kenyan, whoever, a gentleman can do any job which is necessary.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, visited a U.N. camp in Juba, but it was cut short yesterday after hundreds of people unexpectedly approached the event. Some of the internally displaced persons living at the camp say they staged a demonstration because they were prevented from meeting Ambassador Haley. Several media outlets yesterday had reported that the protest was against President Salva Kiir. IDPs also accused organizers working with a French charity at the camp of not wanting Haley to see the miserable conditions under which they live. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Tud Albino, deputy chairman of POC3 at the UNMISS camp in Juba, says he and other IDPs had been anxiously waiting the arrival of Ambassador Haley to express their hope that Haley would help bring peace to their war-torn country. When they were denied meeting the U.S. ambassador by the French charity ACTED, Albino says IDPs reacted violently.
We are celebrating, the community are celebrating, but the reaction has happened after the act denied the community to meet with a visitor. After act divert the Beno from the right Beno, so the community has reacted. After the reaction, they went to office of act and it resolved to the destroying of the act office. And even now, act office is totally destroyed.
Albino says ACTED brought a woman from outside the camp to represent them before Ambassador Haley, denying residents the chance to meet her personally and express their concerns.
They prepared a lady that they brought outside the camp, which is not in the camp. And they prepared her with the four children, and they say this is the mother of the orphan that can come and talk on behalf of the community here in the camp. So after the community realized that there's something happened like that, this is what made them to react so much.
James Mabor, another IDP at the camp, says the reason ACTED did not want Ambassador Haley to meet with them was because the residents of the camp are not well cared for, adding that some are wearing the same clothes they had on when they arrived at the camp 4 years ago.
At a certain stage, ACTED, which is the lead agency in the camp here, is the one to supervise the overall welfare of the IDPs. Suddenly, it was realized that it fell short of certain obligations, which involved providing cooking utensils, some clothes for kids, blankets, and so on and so forth. And the clothes brought along with you 3 to 4 years ago would be worn out. If you have no alternative, you are bound to wear them. So you look sheepish. All these people came around and were in the street of the camp here. ACTED didn't want that.
Mabor says they believe Ambassador Haley's visit to the camp was diverted under a pretext of false security concerns.
ACTED tried to influence the guests that there was insecurity. But the fact was that it didn't want the guests to see these people in that shape. Some are in rags and wearing some blankets. The people themselves know ACTED has fallen short of certain obligations. ACTED is supposed to clean the latrines. You know the compound is really smelly because the latrines have not been cleared for some time. They promised that they would clear them today. They didn't do that.
ABC News and the Associated Press reported yesterday that Haley's security team decided it was not safe for the ambassador at the camp and escorted her away, cutting the event short by a few minutes. ACTIT was not readily available to comment on the accusations made by some IDPs that the protest was not against President Kiir, but rather about being able to meet Haley in person. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
South Sudan's economic crisis is compelling men in some communities to abandon deeply entrenched labor divisions between men and women and take on jobs that were previously considered women's work only so they can earn money to feed their families. Munyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
36-year-old Abraham Lual juices avocados, bananas and passion fruit in a blender before his customers arrive. He then places the fruit mixture in a refrigerator to keep it nice and cold before he pours it into chilled glasses once his customers arrive. Lual's juice shop is located at Shirkat, 3 kilometers outside of Juba on the Juba-Numili Road. Some people in the community see what Lual is doing as a taboo because they think smart young men should not prefer food, wash dishes, or serve customers' drinks. They believe that sort of work is the domain of women and women only. Lual says he is not bothered by what people think as long as he makes money.
Culture will not provide you with what you want. Like here in South Sudan, many guys after culture, they tuck in, they work smart, but you see them suffering. I myself decide I better do like other countries, Ugandan, Kenyan, wherever a gentleman can do any job which is necessary for him to do so that he earn money and survive for the life.
In the past, cultural beliefs dictated black and white labor divisions between men and women, which would often keep young people in poverty. But South Sudan's economic crisis has forced a change in attitude among some people like Lual, who have decided to ignore cultural norms in order to improve their lives. Before opening his juice shop in February, Lual served in the South Sudan Army. As a soldier, his monthly salary of 900 South Sudanese pounds could not cover all of his family expenses. Now, he earns enough to take care of his family's needs. On an average day, after deducting his expenses, Lual serves about 1,000 South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $5.50, something that used to take him a month to serve. Abiem Akuk Bek owns a hand-washing laundry shop commonly known as Dobi, work that is typically seen as women's work. Speaking in Dinka, Bek says customers often appear confused when they first walk in.
Many people come here and ask for the woman working here, but we tell them there is no woman here. We tell them that it is us men who are doing the laundry here. So actually, there is nothing bad about work that you do with your own hands. What is shameful is stealing people's things.
Beg has been operating his laundry business for the past 2 years. He says he earns about 2,000 South Sudanese pounds, or $11 a day. Before opening the Dromat in 2015, he was unemployed and often struggled to survive, which he says forced him to think outside the box. Beck says since running his business, he has been able to take care of his family's needs, including paying for his children's school fees. Many in the community, including women, were surprised to see young men take on work traditionally viewed as women's work. Arok Yak is one of them.
Actually, it's not good for a man to wash a plate because it's not his duty as a young man, but it's mine. Because I feel guilty, I'm a Sudanese, and it's not good for men to wash. But there's a point where you can say, yes, you can do it, because it's a business.
Juba resident Nyapi Nyatim says she has no problem with a man washing glasses or any other job, so long as it enables that man to put food on the table for his family.
This man is better than others who are just playing, who are drunkards. Others who are sitting idleness can cause you many things. You can go and steal. You can go and take somebody's thing. He is not relaxing. He is busy. And that work also is helping him. Maybe by the end of the day, he can get something.
For VOA News, I am Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
A top UN official in South Sudan says local NGOs are uniquely qualified to provide humanitarian aid across the country. But local groups say they face enormous obstacles when trying to reach people in need. Representatives of local NGOs are meeting in Juba for a three-day exposition this week to showcase their efforts and to ask international donors for help, as we hear from Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Alan Naudejo, the Deputy Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, is calling on local aid workers to do more to help the most vulnerable across the country, saying they know best how to reach people in need quickly.
When disaster strikes, local actors are often the first to respond. In the context of South Sudan, conflict and insecurity in many parts of the country have made it increasingly challenging for international actors to access all the people in need. The engagement of and partnership with national entities is increasingly needed to consult with local population and to deliver humanitarian assistance that is truly effective.
Naudejo says local NGOs constitute 90% of the humanitarian workforce across South Sudan. This year alone, Naudejo says, 137 humanitarian organizations have stepped up to provide assistance to the vulnerable, and 60% of that response was handled by local NGOs.
In South Sudan, local organizations are growing in strength, in impact, and becoming more organized, better informed, and more engaged. Now, this is a welcome trend that should be fully supported and encouraged as we go forward.
South Sudanese NGOs officials say they want to do more to help the vulnerable, but face many challenges when trying to deliver aid to the needy. They say some communities prevent local aid workers from accessing the vulnerable on the basis of ethnicity. Apoyo Judis works with the Integrated Development Organization.
Even if you have the funding, some of the community members have attitude based on the ethnicity. You get to the field there, they you know this current ethnicity, others, you get there, they will tell you are an Equatorian, you're not supposed to be here and all that stuff.
As a result, Judis say, some organizations are not able to extend their projects to certain areas. Joseph Modi is a monitoring and evaluation officer with the Juba-based Humanitarian and Development Consortium. He says compounding the problem of gaining access to remote areas are South Sudan's impassable roads, which become worse during the rainy season. The only way to reach remote areas is by plane, and Modi says local NGOs lack the resources to charter flights to deliver aid.
Movement without actually, you cannot use a car, you move on foot. Operating in Pibor, like last week I'd been in Pibor, the whole area is flooded. You cannot use a car, you move on foot. It is really a national building mission. I would really request that if the international community and our international organizations are really able to support national NGOs with the funding and building their capacities, I think national NGOs will be able to do a lot.
Naudejo says in order to do that, national NGOs must coordinate with local NGOs.
With ever-increasing needs and diminishing resources, engaging all actors within the humanitarian system through a coordinated effort is essential to have maximum impact. The humanitarian needs that are upcoming our way probably will not probably be diminished, but we don't always able to count on the resource that will be there to be exactly at the level that we might want. The best thing to do is to find the most efficient way to use those resources to have the biggest impact.
The South Sudan NGO Forum, an umbrella group of both local and international NGOs, organized this week's expo at the Nyakrun Cultural Center in Juba under the theme Working 24/7 to Achieve Lasting Peace and Sustainable Development in South Sudan. Jane Alphonse, who organized the expo, says local NGOs must meet the challenging task of providing aid to the most affected populations, which she says would be doable if the fighting would end. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's election day again in Kenya. What's happening at the polls? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
at what age do you think children can learn how to cook?
At the age of 10, a parent should be able to have taught the children how to cook so that as they grow further, they know most of the things and don't have to face challenges.
Basing on their ability, because I won't give a specific age. Maybe you are 10, but you are strong enough and you can grab something here and there and work. Yes, I don't give a specific age of that, but your ability. As long as you can able, good.
I believe that kids should learn cooking when they're wrong, when they start understanding.
I must say 16 years, but my experience is always is that I used to train children how to cook because my mother taught me how to cook when I was 6 years. So the idea is that somebody needs to become independent.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Earlier this month, the U.S. government enacted the Women, Peace and Security Act of 2017, which President Donald Trump signed into law on October 6th. The bipartisan act is designed to bolster international efforts to prevent, mitigate and resolve conflict by increasing women's participation in negotiation and mediation processes. Jamil Biggio, Senior Fellow for Women and Foreign Policy at the Center on Foreign Relations, says the act reinforces credible research showing that women's involvement in negotiating peaceful outcomes reduces conflict. She also tells Ayen Bior that peace agreements are 64% less likely to fail if women are involved.
This is a landmark act that the U.S. Congress passed earlier this month that requires the U.S. government to promote women's contributions to peace and security. So it recognizes that women have will bring great value to achieving peace, to preventing conflict in their countries around the world, and it requires the U.S. government to support them. And this means supporting women to participate in peace negotiations. It means ensuring that women benefit from the training that the U.S. government provides that relates to peace and security efforts. It encourages the U.S. government to provide support to the local women's groups on the ground who are doing the critical work to support their communities and promote peace and recovery in their societies.
Do you think that the act will have any influence in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in a country like South Sudan?
I do. South Sudan is a country with an incredibly rich network of women peace builders and women leaders who have already been for years looking to contribute to peace from the grassroots, from their villages and communities up to the formal peace process and the efforts by the government and all actors to achieve a peaceful situation. So South Sudan's a perfect example where there are women leaders that are there, that are looking for opportunities where actors like the U.S. government and others in the international community can just help to reinforce the messages that they are already delivering, can perhaps provide more assistance to further the work that these women leaders are already doing in their communities.
What does the research say about women's impact in a peace process?
So there has been statistical research that has looked at peace processes all over the world and has found that, in fact, when women and civil society are able to participate in a peace agreement and in a peace process, it makes the agreement 64% less likely to fail. And there's been analysis to understand why this is, and there are different reasons that influence different processes. Women are able to build networks across diverse groups, across religious, ethnic, and cultural groups to promote common values and common priorities in a peace process. Women are often seen as honest brokers by negotiating parties and are able to help elevate attention to certain issues. In some peace processes, they've employed high-profile tactics to help bring parties to the table and to mobilize public opinion after agreements are signed and in support of the progress, in support of the agreement. We also see in some countries that women are more likely to raise social issues in the negotiations. And these are the kinds of issues that, in fact, when included in the agreement, help societies reconcile and recover. Women are actually more likely to direct post-conflict resources to the needs on the ground and to helping communities recover. We've also seen that when there are high levels of women's participation in government roles, whether as police officers, judges, teachers, medical attendants, it can actually improve the quality of the services that are provided to communities. And we also see that when there are higher levels of women's participation in politics and in society, so for example, when there are more women represented in parliament, it actually decreases the risk of relapse, of conflict relapse over time. And so I know, you know, looking at the situation in South Sudan now, it's all the more critical that women continue to have the opportunity to participate at all levels of society.
That was Jamil Biggio, Senior Fellow for Women and Foreign Policy at the Center on Foreign Relations. She was speaking to Ayen Bior from New York. Kenyans voted today in the country's second presidential election. However, turnout appears lower than it was for the August 8th poll, and violent protests have erupted in some opposition strongholds. Security issues have forced voting in several areas to be delayed until Saturday. The Supreme Court had ordered a rerun of the first poll, citing irregularities it blamed on the country's Electoral Commission. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Jacob Maina cast his vote in Dagoretti, an area of Nairobi that is considered a ruling party stronghold.
Things were good, actually cool, but the people didn't show up like last time.
A poll worker in Nairobi's Mathare slum said that out of 656 registered voters at that location, only about 50 people came to vote between 6 a.m. and 11 a.m. Thursday. She said that during the August election, more than 200 voters cast ballots during the same period. Opposition leader Raila Odinga instructed his supporters to boycott this election after his demands to delay the vote and replace members of the Electoral Commission were turned down. President Uhuru Kenyatta, the winner of the first election, which the Supreme Court nullified, said Thursday that 90% of the country is calm, is peaceful, and is voting. He also said the rights of both those who choose to vote and those who choose to boycott should be respected. Kibera resident Silas Odwali Omuse used a football analogy to explain his decision not to vote.
But where one team goes to play and the other one is not playing, then that one is not a match. I can go and watch. That's why I avoided to participate.
Frederick Mondi Otieno says he did not vote because his preferred candidate was not participating. He says there is no voting because there is no president to vote for. Although the majority of polling stations were peaceful, some were not. In the western city of Kisumu, in Odinga's stronghold, many polling stations did not open for security concerns, with protesters setting up roadblocks and lighting fires. One man died from gunshot wounds, and three others were wounded. In the Nairobi slums of Kibera and Mathare, police fired tear gas and protesters threw rocks. One man was shot dead in Mathare. Amnesty International said its researchers witnessed at least 12 young men in Kibera trying to block the entrance to a polling station, with police firing tear gas to disperse them. And in the Mombasa slum of Bangladesh, youth smeared feces on the walls of a polling station and chased away election workers until order could be restored. The majority of Kenya's coastal region was peaceful as of mid-afternoon Thursday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, police and opposition supporters have had running confrontations throughout the day in Kisumu, Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga's hometown. Mohammed Yusuf is in the city reporting for VOA and spoke this past hour with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson just after visiting the city's main hospital.
The hospital, we have seen injured people with gunshot wounds. So far, four.
Who was doing the shooting?
I think there was this running battles that was taking place within the city between the police and some protesters.
So the protesters were trying to block voting.
Yes, block voting. Yeah, exactly.
At this point, have there been any deaths reported in the city?
So far, the doctors told us that there is only one person who was brought with gunshot wound and died while undergoing treatment at the hospital, at the main hospital.
How are conditions otherwise in the city?
There's still some pockets of protests taking place within the city. A while ago, I was just not far from where I am at the moment. There was running battles between the protesters and the police, and you could hear gunshots, and that what was taking place just close to me at the moment. But most of the parties really hard at the moment to move within the city because roads are blocked and there are youths all over the streets and roads.
What was voting like in the city? Was there any voting at all?
There was no voting. What we have seen, we visited several polling stations. There were no activities. There was nothing going on. And we went to the main constituency center where there was planning and where the polling material was supposed to be distributed from to the polling centers. And by the time we were there, up to four or five, there was nothing going on and polling materials were not distributed. And we're getting reports from Nairobi that the head of the Electoral Commission has ordered a repeat of the election, for example, in Kisumu on Saturday and close towns like Siaya and Migori and Homa Bay.
Those are all part of Mr. Odinga's stronghold, I take it.
That's correct. That is the main opposition, Raila Odinga's stronghold in part of in Nyanza region.
Does the city seem like things are going to settle down for the evening or could things get worse today?
Not really. So far, it's about sunset, maybe 30 minutes before the sun goes to sleep. And yeah, there's still that engagement between the police and the youths. And by the announcement this evening, this afternoon by the Electoral Commission that the election will go on Saturday, that increases more tension and probably many people fear that there will be deaths and even injuries before it may be tomorrow. I assume the protests will go on.
That's Mohammed Yusuf speaking this past hour with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson from Kisumu, Kenya. That's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Celebrate by Isaka Number One.
Isaka Number One, Bidugu Bonate Independent, celebrate South Sudan Independence Day.
Celebrate,
celebrate,
my Bidugu Sudan, celebrate,
Masau Sudan. Arfa alam kadina po, nezil alam ta Sudan gedim. Arfa alam ta Sudan gedi, arfa alam ta junub Sudan.
We've been listening to Isaka Number One with a song, Celebrate. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. We appreciate you choosing to make us a part of your evening. We'd like to know what you think about the show. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or check us out on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.